This is Sons of the Flag Radio, brought to you by Fire Engineering Blog Talk Radio. Our mission at Sons of the Flag is to revolutionize burn care and the quality of life for veterans, first responders, and families. Sons of the Flag believes that the future of burn care resides in research and development. Our vision is to accelerate the process of testing leading technologies and pushing them into circulation for immediate use by burn survivors across the nation. We are truly thankful for the support that everyone continues to show Sons of the Flag, even during the midst of these difficult times. Your support is what allows our mission to keep pressing forward, and for that we are truly thankful for you and all that you have done for us. We'd like to start off tonight's show by honoring our brothers and sisters that we've lost since our last show. Charles Morton, Gene Dean, Ricky Fulton, Richard Todd, Charles C. Woods, Dylan Cunningham, Edward Minnick, Jason Cortez, Lemuel Bruce, Keith Williams, Harold Boone, Johnny Iveson Jr., Matthew Bennett, Sean Laughlin, Joseph Gallo, Michael Butendorp, Robert Rocha, Robert Cray, Alan DiBasso, Robert Orkies. Let us take a moment of silence for these fallen heroes. On our last episode, we played a past episode that discussed finding purpose in tragedy and how the firefighting community can better support one another through grief counseling, suicide prevention, and PTSD. We sat down with Brendan McDonough of the Granite Mountain Hotshots, burn survivor and Colorado Task Force leader Devin Barnhart, and Sons of the Flag Task Force Director Chad Gruber. If you'd like to listen to this episode or any other Sons of the Flag episodes, then log on to Fire Engineering Blog Talk Radio and look up Sons of the Flag. Be sure to also look up Sons of the Flag on all social media by typing in at Sons of the Flag. You can also access information about our mission at Sons of the Flag, find out a bit more of who we are, and any of our upcoming events by logging onto our website at www.sonsoftheflag.org. We are still holding our year-long raffle for the customized Rad Rides H1 Hummer, and due to the unforeseen circumstances with COVID, we have decided to extend the sweepstakes for a bit longer. You can still join the sweepstakes by logging on to www.sonsoftheflag.org/Hummer. $20 will get you one chance to win and $100 for six chances to win, with all the proceeds going to fund our mission at Sons of the Flag. A special thanks and shout out goes to Ryan Appleman for the donation of the H1 Hummer to support our cause. Tonight on Sons of the Flag Radio, we have a great episode for you. We will be sitting down with retired Cleveland firefighter and strategic fire training director Jeff Shoup and Seattle Fire Department's and the man behind the nozzle forward class, Aaron Fields. They will be discussing mentorship, engine companies, and basically pretty much anything that comes to their mind. I'm now going to turn this episode over to Task Force member Chad Gruber.
Thank you, Justin, and thank you to Fire Engineering Blog Talk Radio for giving us the opportunity to do this Sons of the Flag radio show for last year. This is going to be the final show of 2020, and you know, I'm not going to lie, 2020, we need a mulligan on this year. It's been a rough year for everybody. Fortunately, through all y'all's support, Sons of the Flag has been able to make it through the year, and we have not had to turn down one patient this year that we were able to help. So thank you to all the firemen that allow us to help our veterans and firefighters throughout the year. Tonight's show is a kind of a dream come true for me. I get to have my mentor on the show, Jeff Shoup. He is well known in the fire service, retired Cleveland Fire Department. He's the creator of strategic fire training, has taught more people than I can imagine. And the only guy that I know that could possibly teach as many people as him is also joining us, and it's Aaron Fields. He's in from Seattle right now, Seattle Fire Department, and creator of Nozzle Forward. Welcome, gentlemen. Thank you for doing this.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, pleasure to be here.
So, Aaron, you know, you came up, and I've heard stories, but I always hear one side of the story. I never get to hear the other side. And y'all only get to see each other maybe, what, once or twice a year when conferences intersect, correct?
It depends on the year. Sometimes it's once or twice. Sometimes it's a few more times.
I know last time I got to see you, we were in Austin together. And good time. Y'all were, a little bit away from us, about 100 yards away, teaching y'all's class?
Yeah.
So how, if you don't mind me asking, how did you meet Shoup, and how did you hear of him?
Yeah, so, I mean, I got early on, I had some very good mentors in the fire service. My father, a lady named Meg Jones that just retired from Seattle, and a guy named Tom Norton. And I had, in the first 3 months, pretty full serving of humble pie on a fire. And I was a little older when I came into the fire service. And I think, you know, based off what this topic is, I think this is an important note, is I was a little older and I'd done other things at a pretty high level. I journeyed in a trade. I'd put myself through college. I'd played a sport that spends its whole time looking for mechanical advantage. And to date, I'm about 34 years into it, and I'm still rolling. And I was fortunate enough, before I ever got into the fire service in the mid-90s, to travel overseas to a country that was predominantly not available to Western travelers. And through hook and crook, got hooked up with this international, these coaches that were, you know, arguably one of the top 10 coaching cadres in the world for this particular sport. And I learned how to practice. And I had mentors. And I knew that, but I was a full-fledged adult. And so when I came into the fire service, I had some really good stuff I learned originally in the first fire academy for the first department. But I didn't have a pretty wide swath of what was going on. I had part of the issue, not the whole issue. You know, and if you only have one option, you don't have choices. And that's, we all talk about choices, and you know, too many choices hurt us, but you need a solid algorithm for making these. And so I ate some humble pie, and in all honesty, it hurt, but it wasn't enough to put me in a burn unit, but it was enough to freak me out. And I think the mental impact was long-standing and wasn't apparent up front. What was apparent up front is where I'd gotten burned up a little bit. And I can remember these guys marching around in the front yard, their chests all puffed out after this fire, talking about what a good fire it was. And I'm, you know, I'm a little older, and I'm thinking, that's the opposite of good. This was not good. And we got it done, but it didn't go well. And, you know, I had had some influences because my dad was involved with, you know, being around a station and the group of people that lost a few people in a fire in the mid-90s. And you know, there was about 6 hours. I thought it was my dad instead of one of the guys that passed. And so I already had a full serving of what it looks like afterward thing goes poorly. And my disillusionment was pretty immediate. You know, all this piss and vinegar and bravado and not a lot of substance. And because I'd done some stuff at another level, it wasn't jiving. And so I was upset. I felt betrayed. I felt like maybe this was the wrong profession because what they told me was going to happen isn't happening. We weren't preparing like tactical athletes or paramilitary. It was more like a fucking club with a t-shirt, a mustache, got enough wax on it, and a bunch of stories. And I was like, I'm not interested in being part of a club. This isn't high school. And I got a couple people that were kind of in helping me out, gave me a book. And it was a couple articles by Andy Fredericks. And I read it and I was like, oh, yeah, this is the part that's missing. And I had picked where I thought he was going to be. This is pre-internet, where he thought he was going to be, was on duty on 9/11. And so never got a chance, clearly, to work with him. And I'd been turned on to his writing probably 6 months before that. But what happened was, is, you know, you could go on this thing called the World Wide Web, and I started doing searches. And, I mean, I know today Jeff and I have talked a lot about the impact of the internet. There is a lot of negative impact.
A lot.
But there's some really good positive impact as well. Because I came across this website that was called Fire Nuggets. And I read everything on it. And I took notes on who was the ones writing. And I started looking as much as I could. I found a conference, and I didn't know anything about FDIC, but I found a conference that Shoup's name came up. I recognized it. I'd read his stuff. I went to my captain and said, I want to go to this conference. And he's like, why? And I'm like, because of this class. I couldn't say because of this guy or this group of guys. I had to say because of this class, it will help our tactical progression in our high-rise operation, right? And I go to this class, and I'm still really green. I think it was 2001, maybe 2002, maybe. And I'm inexperienced and in a suburb.
How long have you been on the fire service? I'm sorry to interrupt. How long have you been on?
Well, I've been 20 years.
Okay. No, so, at this time, 2002. So
yeah, like 1 or 2 years.
Okay.
Yeah, and I mean, my progression started immediately. I mean, I was 3 months in the job, and we caught a fire, and from that point on, the switch was lifted. And so I went to this class, and there was a bunch of people in it. Well, a bunch. Most people were getting their IFSAC certification and feng shui and rope rescues. But there was people in this class. And there were, you know, I'm new. I don't understand how the system works. And there were a bunch of guys from very big departments and small departments. And, you know, in all honesty, the class was phenomenal. And I can, you know, I took notes on it and all that. But the way the instructors, and specifically Jeff, behaved was very contrary to what I'd had up to that point. And, you know, here I am. I'm a new firefighter that is searching out part of a skill set. And you know, Jeff doesn't know my name. Didn't know my name. Surely didn't know. Listen, the town that I was working for did not have a college football team. He didn't know where it was on the map. He's like, he was somewhere towards Japan, right? And because this was a suburb of the city of Seattle. And so we go and we're doing this evolution. And the evolution was, you know, a funny thing. We went up the stairs. It was a 180 stair, the 2.5. We went up the stairs into a large open space. And my fire training had been 400 BTUs of pallets in a concrete building that doesn't burn, with nothing in between us, with things like don't flow too much water, don't disrupt the thermal balance. Like that was all that was said. And there was no further definition of whens and whys and wheres and hows. So we're doing an evolution, and Jeff's right behind me, and I hit the fire in a way that's inappropriate, especially for this space. And he stops me and he's like, oh, no, this is what's going on. He's like, we're playing make-believe, or he said something like that. And we do it again.
It was probably that wonderful tone of voice he has when he starts barking.
No, he wasn't barking at all, actually. It was very like, no, this is the evolution. And so we did it again, and I basically made more or less the same mistake. And he started talking to me, and I can remember and now having taught 37,000 people with the nozzle forward, I know what the look means when they're like, oh, we've got to step back a couple steps here. The assumption that I made about this person's knowledge and experience base isn't off. But At no point was I demeaned, degraded, or spoken down to. I was spoken with, not at. And in this class where there was a bunch of people vying for his attention, you know, he was a name. And in many ways, the fire service is more about the name than the skills. Yes?
Yeah.
And
I have a feeling that
on a popular level, right? And I'd had world-class coaching with guys that were really good. And I was never demeaned or talked down to. Unlike the fire service, which up to this point, except for three people, I was more or less down or demeaned, which tells me as someone that's done some other shit, I'm not 22-year-olds and naive, that these guys that are doing that don't know. And they're using their bluster and bravado so that I don't ask questions because I'm made to feel. I mean, I was told in my very first fire academy, when I asked a really good, legitimate question, I was told, because I said so, sit down, I'll tell you everything you need to know. And that was immediate for me. I was like, oh, that's bullshit. I can ask any of these coaches that know I'm not going to go to the Olympics for their team, and they'll explain to me why I'm standing up the way I'm standing up between drills and moving from one point, and why practice is achieved the way or done the way it is. And all of this. So when I came in, it was a huge letdown, except for three people and then Jeff. And so I remember it took, I don't know, it felt like about 20 minutes, but maybe it was 10. Nevertheless, you know, he's, and having worked at FDIC, he's in FDIC, which is down and dirty. I mean, we do the highlights of a 24-hour class in 8 hours. And it's all about keeping the whole thing moving. And he took himself out of everything else to make sure that this firefighter that didn't work next to him, that he was never going to see again, that worked in a place that didn't even have a college football team, understood what he was doing and why. And so I did it again. And this time I got it right. And he's like, that's right. Makes sense? I'm like, yep. He's like, great. That was it. And so my exposure to him was 8 hours. And then all of the stuff that he wrote. And so that was, you know, that was my, and now, you know, we've gone from that where, you know, he's like, I don't, you know, whatever. And he moved on and probably didn't think about it again. But you know, I think one of the things is he knew what he was doing, so he didn't have to fool me. He didn't have to use that approach and that attitude to fool me. It would have been much easier for him to say and think to himself, man, I'm going to have this conversation again. You see my body of work, and I've got to have 101 again. But he did it, and he did it without any resistance, without any hesitation, and without any bullshit. And I was like, well, that was refreshing. And in some ways, those first four people, Norton, my dad, Meg, and Jeff, probably saved my career, because there's been twice in 20 years where I've literally been to the point of like, you know what? I'm not interested in some JV bullshit. I want to be fucking all world class, and I'm going to do the preparation to try to get there. And I'm always going to have stuff I can work on. And I'm driven to be good because my public demands it. And I demand it of myself. And this first thing, I mean, indirectly and directly, probably helped save my career, because I would have went and done something where the average person, average participant, holds themselves to a higher standard. Because excellence, the pursuit of excellence, has always been my, you know, at personal cost, in whatever I do. You know, comfort is the enemy of growth. If you're comfortable, you're not growing. And if you're not growing, you're just regurgitating. So that was my first experience. And it was awesome. And then I think our first year at FDIC. Well, on a side note, one of the things I know, because Jeff and I have talked about a lot, is that I always cite all my sources. I do the same things in a slightly different mechanical way. I describe it in a different way, and I describe it from the perspective of someone that fights fire in my buildings, which aren't buildings in this Midwest or Dallas or New York. There's some, we all have some similarities, but there's some things that are fundamentally different. And so I had to take a skill set, and because I've learned how to do systems, not techniques, I just kept twisting and tweaking and taking more classes with other guys and went from there. And then FDIC, what was it, Jeff? Yeah, it was probably 7 years ago. He walks up and he's like, "Hey, you're Aaron Fields. I'm Jeff Shoup. We need to talk." And I was like, "I know who you are. Introduce yourself. I'm surprised you know who I am, because I look like a bum, like a clean bum, all facial hair all grown out." And that's where it's gone. That's, you know, that's a long answer to a simple question, but there are several levels of nuance that are indicative of what we're going to be talking about.
I can only thank you. And, you know, I know I've told you this before. Thank you. And I've used our relationship when I've talked to people, you know, when I talk about culture and things in the job and so forth, you know, and respect. And I can always use that term respect in a two-way sense. Okay. Yeah. How we work together. And 8 years later, from the time we first met, by the way, was that the training center we were at? Roseville, California, where they sent us out to?
I don't know, maybe.
This is back about that time.
Yeah.
We were out there a couple times, you know.
I think I remember you saying I was there the first time you were there. But whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyways, then we went to LA and so forth. But anyways, that respect is it's a two-way street, because as an instructor, and again, great story. And if the instructor's out there, as you say, pumping their chest up and stuff like that and so forth, you know, doesn't work. And really, I don't even know how to say it, but you know, that respect that you gave me, I give to you. That's that two-way street. Yeah. It's a two-way street, because I always tell people, I says, look, you as an instructor, you're not there for your own ego. You're supposed to be there to depart information into your students. And, you know, by doing it a certain way, you gain more. And besides, you never know who in your class is going to be the next Aaron Fields.
Oh, I appreciate that.
I say that all the time.
Aaron, now, I will tell you, he says that every class we teach. Yep. He says, you never know who's going to be the next Aaron Fields.
Yep.
You know, it's go ahead. I'm sorry.
The other thing was, from our first meeting, and you talked about my articles in Fire Nuggets and so forth, and that's when, you know, Ted Corporani and Paul Schuler still were running Fire Nuggets.
That's right.
It was 8 years later that I got that call from Ted. He says, "Hey, Jeff, you know, hey, there's a guy looking for you. He wants to find out some background on you." You know, and I said, "Oh, who is it?" And he says, "Yeah, I'm some guy named Aaron Fields." Well, hell, I get on the computer. I start looking up Aaron Fields. And I said, "Oh, really? Yeah." He says he had you as an instructor years ago out here. I said, "Oh, okay." And so we went through it and so forth. And I says, "Oh, okay, that's possible." As you say, you know, as an instructor in a situation like that, you help and you nurture if you can. If we're on different sides of the country, you can't always, you know, have that, you know, one-on-one relationship. It's hard. But what you did following my work afterwards and following, you know, things that, you know, I was involved with, tremendous. And, you know, it just made it that when Ted called me, I said, "Okay, let's see what goes on here." And I think it was 4 years later, three or four
about
years.
About 8 years, because after the class with you, there was several more years of really actively taking other classes. And I think I taught my first one. I mean, I was invited to show some stuff and teach a class. It would have been about 8 years from, that's about right. Because I think I worked on the skill set for the better part of a decade. And then somebody said, hey, would you show this? And, you know, it's the other thing that I think people miss is that when you cite your sources, not only is it ethical and respectful, it's also demystifies. Like this idea that, you know, I mean, and for the record, after that class, you'll appreciate this, Chad. After that class, I looked twice a year at Cleveland to see if they were going to hire. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm actually willing to move to Cleveland. There's no goddamn ocean there. Like, you know, it's like, but you know, it's like, they were not hiring. So, and in some ways it's probably just as well. Because I've learned things in other arenas from people that I have never physically worked with. I've read that because we speak the same language and we have the same basic body orientation to whatever it is we're doing, I can read somebody from Hungary or Georgia on a particular throw and I can figure out how to do it because we both speak the same language. We have the same concept of objective in mind. You can't do that before you have skills, but once you have skills and they reach a certain point of proficiency, you can look at something and get not all of it. You still need instruction, but you can get the basics and the generalities. And if it's cited, if sources are cited, it's ethical, it's respectful, it's legal, and it demystifies. You know, I grow weary of people telling me that the way I hold hose is new. It's not new. It's learned. The lock position that Shoup uses is the root of that. And another position I use, but funny thing is, it's just about the time you think something's original, and people like to be original instead of just being good. Someone shows me a picture from 1911 of two firefighters doing a series of things that look eerily similar. And it's always what I've said. It's like nothing's freaking new. And if you don't cite your sources, the appearance is that you're trying to make it new. And what the appearance should be is these are my refinements, my personal refinements and my systemizing of this long-standing tradition in which I am part of. And that's real transmission of information. It's not you got to be new and original and put a new spin on it. It's no, just freaking be good at it. Human body is not finite. It is finite. It only moves in so many ways. So there's a limited number of options available.
The older you get, the less motions it has.
As much as I would like to be back at the edge, I really, really would. Just to take the line in, you know, for the excitement and the job itself. I just think about, oh God, could I do this 2 or 3 or 4 times a night after midnight, you know?
Yeah,
like the old days. No, it's not there.
Yeah,
and that's age.
Well, and we remember the good fires. What we don't remember is, I'm sorry, sir, you're 40 years old and you have a stomachache, and it's 2:30 in the morning, and you've called someone that the half an inch above Boy Scout. Like, what do you think's wrong? I think you have a stomachache. I don't know. I'm not a fucking doctor. Why am I? I think our EMS protocol should be this simple: is all the blood in your body. Yes or no? Is your heart beating? Yes or no? You're clearly talking, so you're breathing. Yes or no? See the physician. That's our protocols.
I can add a couple to that, but you know, in the essence of time.
Yeah.
Aaron, I will tell you, even though he is a lot whiter haired than the pictures he showed, when we teach, he is the first one. I still don't understand how he gets up on top of a hose bed so fast. And
both very complimentary, very, and I thank you for that, you know.
So. No, my goal is to beat you, but it doesn't happen. So,
can you on?
Well, then you're not moving fast enough.
I know. I know. I just,
you got to cheat. You got to cheat, Chad.
It's humbling. It's like you said, I get humbled every time. You know, so, Shoup, this is going to sound like something you've said before. This mentorship that y'all have going, you know, I know Aaron, when I'm talking to him, I talk to him probably 3 or 4 times a week. He's like, you know, the closest thing I have to a father on this earth now.
You know, a mentor doesn't have to be in your department. You know, we say firefighting's geographical, local, and circumstantial. Well, I think the same thing can go for mentorship too as well, don't you think, Shoop?
Yes, I do. I absolutely do. Because there's people who I've taken things from them and learned from them. But don't forget, you know, I was a student one time myself. I was going to FDIC back in the late 80s when it was in Cincinnati, Ohio. You know, it was just a four-hour drive down the road, you know, and I remember when they picked up from Cincinnati and moved west to Indianapolis and so forth. So I went through the student situation also, learning and sitting with people and so forth and talking with people and thinking, oh my God, this guy's got so much to offer. That's one of the things I like, you know, to put up. I've got a slide in one of my presentations where I put a whole bunch of names there, you know, people I've either read their work, watched them, did some background research on them, or even met with them. Dennis Smith is one of those names. I remember when he came up with the book Report from 82. And 15 years later, I thought, yeah, his book really, you know, it was like tremendous. It brought firefighting into the homes of people across America because nobody knew what the American firefighter was up against back then, especially in an urban situation. So, like I said, I got his book, picked it up a long time in the early 70s. And in 87, I was working with an officer whose daughter was doing a summer internship from college, home from college, at the Cleveland Plain Dealer. And Dennis Smith was coming through touting his book, Firefighters, Their Lives in Their Own Words. He'd already written a report from 82, 15 years earlier. And so this girl calls her dad. Her dad says, hold on, I got a guy in my firehouse, you know. I think we should pair these guys up. And I had a sit-down, and an article came out in the Cleveland Plain Dealer, me and Dennis Smith together. And I think I got a copy of that I put up also. And he went across the country talking with firefighters, putting down their stories and so forth. And some of them were really pretty exciting things and so forth. Firefighters getting hurt, but not giving up the fight, coming back and so forth. You know, it was just tremendous and so forth. So that guy meant a lot to me because he was just a fireman. And I like to tell people that. You don't have to be an officer. You don't have to be a chief or a captain or anybody with rank to be knowledgeable and to move the job forward to have a positive impact on people, okay? Rank means nothing, okay? You know what it's like to be up against a person with rank who, you know, doesn't have it or whatever, so forth. So that meant a lot to me that Dennis Smith took that and look what he did. Firehouse Magazine, Firehouse Conference, and all that other stuff, you know, that grew from that and so forth. But, yeah.
Go ahead, Aaron.
Yeah, I think that there's several awesome leads from that leadership is a behavior. Hmm. If you look it up in the dictionary, it's a behavior pattern. And healthy fire departments and healthy people encourage leadership at every level. And if we're going to call it a chain of command, then we need to quit treating it like a one-way superhighway. Chains of command means that there's a point on both ends of that link that we each represent. There's crossover. But each link is equally responsible. I'm as responsible to my chief as my chief is to me. We have different jobs. But I think one of the things that really recently stood out to me is this is something I've been saying for a long time, is that leadership is a behavior pattern, not a rank. And it's exhibited at every level. And it's good leaders know when to let other people go and when to stay out of the way. But I actually reread it 6 months ago. I probably read it 12, 13 years ago, and then reread it, not no more than 6 months, about a year, year and a half, Warfighting by the United States Marine Corps. They define what a Marine does and what characteristics they should exhibit, regardless of rank. It doesn't say McCain colonels should do this. It is, this is what we do as Marines. This is what we expect from all Marines. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, and it's, I actually think it's a phenomenal, I think it might be one of the best written mission statements of the 20th century, devoid of all the kind of stereotypical hoorah. And it was written in 1976, and it's just as semantically applicable today as it was then. It's a phenomenal document. And so I think, you know, this, what Jeff was talking about with leadership, leadership can be exhibited from everywhere. And I think one thing we have to remember is that water boils from the bottom, that tactics are determined by the ability to succeed at the task level. So there's this predisposition towards putting modern fire service, I think, of putting the tactic ahead of the technique. And you can't do that. It's got to go the other way, because if you don't have technical ability, then your tactical choices are limited. The other thing, I think, something that you said, Chad, that stands out to me is that when we say mentor, mentors come in all kinds of places. And it is possible to have a mentor relationship of elder to junior. But because our myth, and I'm not saying that that's not appropriate and applicable, but because of our cultural myth, that's the only way we talk about it. I have mentors that I can't stand. I learn things that are work from people that I don't care for because they were always screaming at me. And they ran a practice like the enemy, you know, smoking cigarettes in old man boots, pushing your arm the wrong way. I didn't like that guy, but I respected him and I learned the lessons, and he mentored me in that arena. And then you have mentors like you referred to, Jeff, like guys that you can call up and you can have a chat, and you've got that kind of relationship. But I think one of the problems, especially with a lot of the younger people in the fire service, is they look at every mentor like they're sage sitting on the mountain. Most mentors mentor a particular topic and then nothing else. But, and it shows, like when we go to conferences, right? One of the things that they'll say is just talk about whatever you want. You don't want me to do that. Now, I'll talk about what I know and what I suppose from what I know. But I'm not going to, you know, I mean, a great example, we had this officer, he's like 33 years old. He promotes. He's doing a fine job, maybe early. I know, not maybe. He promoted early. But he's humble enough to know he's got to get good at it. So he came into our fire station, and at the time, he's like, I don't know, he's probably 30. And he starts, because, you know, an officer in the fire service is like a nautical captain in the age of sail in England. They're master and commander next to God, right? They know everything. You get promoted, you know everything. So this guy, this child, starts talking to us, an established senior crew, on marriage. And in his 6 months of a marriage, or a year of a marriage, all the stuff that he's had to do. And I looked at him, I'm like, bro, how old are you? And he's like, I'm 30. I'm like, I've been married for 3 years less than you've been alive. Why don't you stick to the front right seat and listen to what, you know? And that is unfortunately in the fire service, because so many people want a relationship and they want to force a relationship, that they look for that relationship in people that frankly don't deserve it. And morally, technically, all of those things, that doesn't mean they don't have something to offer you. But it's rare that you find mentors that you like completely and that you can agree or have subtle differences on takes on things, but still have that kind of mutual respect that Jeff talked about. And I think it's cool that that can come in so much variety, but I think we as an industry need to talk about it in those terms, that sometimes the mentor is professional, purely, not personal. And we blur those lines, and that leads to a lot of the confusion. It is rare, in my experience in life, it is rare to find someone as an adult that I look to as, you know, I'm almost 50 years old. I don't need fathers. I need peers, And I need guys that I trust, I know have my back, that maybe have an expertise that I don't have. So, you know, it's such an interesting dynamic thing, but it doesn't tell the stories. You know, we don't get to propagate the fire service myth when people are like, no, I don't really like the guy. He had some really good stuff to teach, but man, he's kind of a jerk. Or, you know, or Fields is a little bit antisocial. Why doesn't he ever go get beers? You know, or whatever. It's just what it is. And I think we have to look at people and really expand on our definition and our conceptual understanding of what true mentorship is. And it fundamentally comes from what you, Dad, and I have talked about with regards to Jeff. And he hit the nail on the head. Mutual respect. Never patronized, never spoken down to. And if he has Jeff asked me my opinion on certain things. You know, I can call him up and say, hey, I don't hit cellar fires that often. True cellar fires. We're built on hills. There's a large percentage of the American Fire Service that would say flowing water on a stairwell isn't something you would do. I will tell you, if you don't, you might get burned up if the backside of that house is two floors below and it vents. But I don't do cellars. And so very often, because we just don't have that demographic. So I had one. It went pretty well, but Jeff's had way more than me. And it was probably, a year ago, Jeff? I called you up and we were like, I'm like, hey, I had a fire. I want to bounce off what I did to make sure that jives so that when I'm codifying this experience into my algorithms, I'm not missing something that's obvious. That's a mentorship relationship. He's like, yeah, shoot. And I tell him what I did. And he's like, ask me a couple of questions. And because starting back with that first class we ever had, I had with him, we spoke the same language. We had the same picture in our mind. And he confirmed that what I did was right. But I'm way more confident about it now than I was then. I'm like, maybe there was something that I missed, you know, that I got through it. But anyway, I mean, there's 3 points made there that stood out to me. Mutual respect, mentorship, and what it is and how it comes in many, many different shapes and sizes. And we have to be able to talk about that nuance because, you know.
Let me throw one in there, okay? And this is going back to my early years in the job. And this is, you know, in the 70s. And a couple of guys I still have contact with. And one of them, Jimmy Mendelera, he's down in Florida, you know, and him and I talked. He says, you remember when we came on the job? He says, you know, we had probably the greatest generation this country has ever seen of people waiting for us to come in. And what they were people who fought in the World War II in Korea. And this is the same story I tell everybody also. And that is, so they've been there in war times. They had those things about discipline. They grew up as children during the Depression. And my parents did, you know. And yeah. So to hear the stories from your family members about how the family unit was so strong, it was because it was survival. So they had, how are we going to feed eight kids and, you know, two or three or four adults tonight, you know, and so forth. And everybody worked together and stayed together as a family unit. Like I said, now fast forward, then World War II comes along in Korea. When these guys got hired into the fire service, remember, they were working on a day, off a day, on a day, off a day, and that was it. There was no three platoon system for the longest time. And these guys still felt like they hit the lottery having a job like that. So here comes the three platoon system and so forth. And then later on, as people are hiring in, myself being one of those kids in the 70s and so forth, and it was like, holy cow, these guys weren't going to put up with your bullshit. But you could go to them. Because a lot of these guys worked the riots and they had been there and so forth. And you could go to them, you know, and they were there to make you a firefighter, a disciplined firefighter. These are the rules, kids. This is what we do and so forth. And this is how we do it. Got that, you know? Yeah. Okay, cool. And of course, in a fire, you know, they'd sometimes, you know, say, okay, this is what we do and this is how we do it and so forth. And it was one of those things. So I think this is 74. Yeah, it's 74, because I was just a few weeks on the job. We're going down this one street for a company on the scene calls in a working fire, and I look across the engine at the older guy who come on in the job in 66. And I says, what do we do when we get there? And he said, follow the senior man. Boom. You know, it was that simple. To that day, we are still close. And as I got older, and my wife and I would get invited over to his house, I'd go over to his house, he'd come over to my house. We lived in the same small town, you know, away from the fire department at that time. We've been with their family events. He's been with my family's events and so forth. And we still have coffee every few weeks when we can, you know. Just that mentorship that started from that, and it's continued all these years. Now it's not so much about the fire department, but it's about life.
Yeah.
Thank you, Neil, for that.
We still go ahead. And the yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah. A lot of chemistry. Yeah.
And really, I mean, that's the one thing that I'll say, though, because the one of the guys that mentored me early on was pre-SCBA. He started a few years before we had to wear masks. And, you know, they'd tell you what they wanted. They'd tell you when they wanted it, why they wanted it. Then they'd show you a couple ways on how. But if you had a question, you could ask.
Yeah.
And those senior guys, I mean, and for me, you included, have never, Meg Jones, my dad, Tom Norton, all these people have never lost their shit because somebody younger than them dared ask them a question. The danger of half understood and reflect, you know, looking at a relationship in the reflection is that a lot of people have taken it to the senior guy gets the say. No, the senior guy gets to explain it. And if we're going to ask our people to exhibit control, then we should expect our senior guys to exhibit control when a junior guy asks them a question. It's right. Not challenging their position. It's they want to know why. And right. That's a mark of trust. And the real senior guys and gals don't lose their crap over a question. Like, when it's a time appropriate, hey, Jeff, I got a question on that last fire. Why did we, this, and this. Right. Not, how dare you? I'll tell you everything you need to know, which is not exhibiting the control that we're asking our new people to exhibit. Like a senior person complaining about a junior person that they don't have any emotional control and they're soft, but at the same time throwing a temper tantrum when they're asked a question. the irony should be lost on us. It's like, you know, how dare you?
So the million-dollar question, and Jeff, you don't have to deal with it. Aaron, you do. Today, I think, and this is my personal opinion, that there's a difference. They want – some of these kids that are coming in, they want friendship as well. I mean, I've told this to Shoop. I always tell it, and I tell it to my son who works at the same fire department I do. It's not my job to be your friend. It's my job to make sure you know how to do what you're doing. And make sure you know how to do your job right and correctly. And I'm not going to get my feelings hurt if you don't call me on a day's off. You know, I want to make sure that you're safe and you get to go home. How do we deal, and I hate to use the term, Aaron, how do we deal with the millennials who did not have?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that the thing to remember is that there are millennials right now in the longest war in American history.
That is true.
And there are recruits that we just have that are millennials that are freaking outstanding in all aspects. So I think just like saying an old person is one way and a not young person is this way, or anybody's one way or the other based on the group, we have to understand that the fundamental difference, and I've given this a lot of thought, the fundamental difference is the younger folks in the for the last 50 years, we've worked hard at teaching people how to avoid difficult conversations instead of how to have them with dignity and respect. And unfortunately, this generation processes information differently than you, I, or Jeff do. And there's nothing we can do about it. They grew up with a computer that gives them instant access. So their time frame is set on instant. So I think what we have to recognize is there is a difference in the way they process information. And fundamentally, they bring some things to the table that you and I don't. So it's about translating those things and teaching them when they ask a question, but they're trying to make a statement. For me, that's the essence of the problem. If a new person comes to me and asks me why, and it's an honest, upfront question, I'm going to answer it. But when they say to me, let me ask you a question, and it's actually a statement in the guise of a question, because they haven't been given by their society the social norms to asking a direct question respectfully. So my response is, the senior members have to remember that these people process information differently, and we can continue to lament it, or we can accept it and learn how to work with it and utilize it, which is a professional disposition. This is what we have. Make it work, which is one of the things. The other thing that we can say is, we want our senior members to understand that asking the question why, if it's a real question, is a mark of trust, not challenging position or authority. For the millennials, I think the thing that they have to do is learn how, for those people that ask, make statements in the guise of a question, they have to learn to ask a question. And if they ask it correctly, we should answer it. And if they don't, we should help them learn how to phrase it. And that comes from modeling. We talk about the way it should be, but we don't emphasize, like, okay, this was a conflict that just occurred with a friend of mine or a person I know. They wanted to go drill, and their senior firefighter told them they knew how. They know how to do it, and they don't want to drill. And so the person goes and figures out how to drill on their own, and the senior's pissed off about it. Like, wait a minute. They want, or asking a question on how to do something, and you're telling them you know how to do it, but you're not showing them. Well, you're not exhibiting the very characteristics that you're asking them to exhibit. And I think that's the catch, is that if I can figure out how to translate their culture to my culture, we can, our time frames, because that's what the difference is, we can figure out how to utilize each other's strengths. And that's been my experience. It takes time. There is no instant fix, but they're going to win this argument, because they're going to outlast us. So if we're really that concerned with the way things, we want to see things be, then we better invest ourselves in making sure they have the tool set to do that. And if they don't, that's on them. But I think I think more gets made out of this than is actually an issue. And I think we forget that there are plenty of people that fall into that millennial age group that are doing amazing things and are exhibiting every feature in any way that any of us would interpret it. And for those that aren't, some of them aren't ever going to, but some of them, when given a medium of expression, do it because they see the results. So I think that's it, you know, and really we have to remember, as a paraphrase or an analogy, that rock and roll music, oh, it's going to be the death of us. Every generation has these kinds of things they have to work out, especially in a hyper-mediated world where, you know, we're not looking at eras in terms of 100 years now, we're looking at them in 5, 10. So with this rapid change, and, you know, we have to be what we say we want. And I think that's, and it's easy to cop out. It's easy to blame it on them. And there is some. Everybody has culpability in it. So
I think you're right. I think it's an easy scapegoat just to blame it on the age difference.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jeff, you have any thoughts on that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm not that far out of the loop, okay? I know I'm closer to 70 than I am to 65, but I'm still, you know, in the loop on this stuff. And that is, you know, what I've seen. And that's the changing in how we look at the younger generations. This has been going on for a long time, not only the millennials, but the generation before them. And it's that thing about the fire service, and this is how I'm looking at it. You know, like I just told you, my example, when I first came on the job, those were all older guys. And this is a system that they lived under. And when we come in, we were going to follow that system. And because it worked for them, they understood it. And it was easy. I shouldn't say easy. That's not a right word. But it was what they knew. Let's say that. They knew that, and they knew how to give it to us. So as time goes on and we go through all these social changes in our society, people coming into the job, younger people coming into the job, wanting to believe that they're equal in ability. Well, Aaron, as you bring up, you know, the millennials who are doing fantastic work, to me, that's something we have to build upon, okay?
Right.
You don't give them that belief, though, coming in, because firefighting has always been a time-honored profession. You know, you just, you know, the way it is. You know, I don't expect anybody with 2, 3, 4, 5 years in a job to come in, get promoted, and start leading a crew into a battle, especially a badass complex situation and so forth. It's just not there. It doesn't work. But I also don't believe you take away, you know, in other words, some of the things what we've seen was that, I keep throwing it out there, the HR people. Oh, well, what are you doing to make this person better? Well, I'll tell you what, I agree. And it's hard to take people who have been in the job, let's just say 15 years and more, to change their thinking around all together to say, oh, you know what? This is just like you talk about the guy, the senior man who, you know, well, we've already done that and I know how to do it and they know how to do it and stuff like that, who's putting a spear in the training session. That's how do you change them? Because you're gonna have to change them also. Because after a while, the younger people, when they start getting a couple of years of the job, they're gonna look at that guy and they say, well, look what he's getting away with. You know, what's our standard that we're looking for? And how do we achieve that? Give an example. So I went back to my old firehouse, oh, several years ago. John was there. And, you know, John is in my Goomba, you know, still at the firehouse. And he had a couple of cadets right out of the academy. And we had the lines laid out, you know, I take the flow meter in, we work with the nozzles and so forth, going over nozzle mechanics in the back parking lot there at the firehouse. But here comes a newly promoted truck boss, a guy who had spent his time 20 years on a truck. So as we're going over nozzle mechanics with these new firefighters, cadets, as they're known here, and I said, hey, Lieutenant, hey, why don't you show these guys, you know, how to hold this nozzle and how you'd work it and so forth. And he says, oh, hell, I've done that 1,000 times. And I says, well, why don't you do it 1,001 then? He gets the nozzle in his hands, and he can barely hold the thing.
Yeah.
The kids look at me. Both of the kids look at me, and the one, I can see the smile, you know, in the corner of his mouth, you know, because they knew what the story was. They knew what the game was with this guy. You know, and like I said, you know, he just, you know, kind of made the story right there.
Right. So what
you have to do to try to take these kids in and build them into the system, you have to have the system above them and everybody working together there to make sure. And that's a tough thing to do, especially for a big organization, as you know. So I don't know.
Yeah.
I think the word you said at the beginning of the podcast, both of y'all, and I think, you know, just my opinion, but it all boils down to respect. Hmm. you have to give them the respect, and to earn the respect, you have to give it. So, you know, it's not, it's a trust then verify, but does that make sense to y'all? I mean, you have to respect the younger generation.
Yeah. Absolutely. And that doesn't mean, like Jeff's saying, is pat them on the back.
No.
And tell them that everything's awesome. That wasn't very good. Let's do it again.
Right.
But I think the one thing that we have to remember, right, I know Jeff doesn't do this, and I'm based off the conversations you and I have had, Chad, I know you don't fall in this too, but I am going to speak totally frankly. I'm fucking sick of firefighters patting themselves on the back and telling themselves that somehow the fire service is somehow more noble and more fixed than the rest of society. It is made up of this people. It's the same problems manifested inside our organizations that are manifested out. And the problem is that so many firefighters think that we're like Knights of the Round Table. Like that our job is noble. No. Our job is our job. Occasionally, we as individuals get the ability to behave nobly in the pursuit of our occupation. That is fundamentally different. We're more in common with a plumber than we have in common with Lancelot. And unfortunately, firefighters go from public servant, a large part of them, go from public servant to publicly into served.
When we
believe our own rhetoric to the point that we misconstrue what we actually do, we can't create those standards that Jeff's talking about. Those come from being honest about what's occurring. And the fire service suffers from the same problems. And when you read the books like Jeff's talking about, when you read William Clark, when you read the cultural books that were written before, and the essays that were written back in the day, they're saying the same things we're saying. I was reading chief notes from 1947 that are still typed. And the guy, the chief says, in his chief notes to other chiefs, the crews perform exceedingly well on fires, but there is too much fisticuffs and roughhouse in fire stations, and I can't get them to keep clean uniforms on. Like, the chief email that same thing today, and it would be the same. It was refreshing to know that, yeah, it's made up of people, and respect is the core of all relationships. Our marriages, our friendships, our people that we don't agree with, we should respect. Our people that we like, it's respect. You're right. I think that's the sum total of the whole thing.
In Ohio, we used to have the Ohio Fire Service Training Manual, which to me was the finest firefighter basic training manual. And if it was updated, it would be the best one today for the fire service. It was honest to gosh, no bullshit stuff. Shepherd's work was in there because they had a section, a whole chapter on water and hydraulics. So what he was doing in his work in the 30s and the 40s, were learning that as a basic firefighter. You were expected to know all those numbers and so forth, because you're supposed to carry those with you throughout your career. And to see the changes that have come about, you know, it's like, what are we doing? We're dumbing down the job. We're not expecting this. You know, talk about ventilation. Of course, I'm an engine guy, you know, but, you know, a section in there on venting peak roofs, windward side, leeward side, where to make the cut here, where to make the cut on that side, things like that. I'm not seeing that done anymore. And that's that loss of professionalism, of knowing your job, you know? Basics, yeah, to me, are basics of the job.
Trade-like training.
Yeah.
You got to know what you call it. You got to know how to do it. It's got to be the same so that if you and I are talking about something, we don't have to define our terms every time we're talking about it, because we're speaking different languages. I mean, you can go anywhere in the country and a header is a header.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so going back to that training manual, when you first opened it up, there were 13 traits they were looking for to be a firefighter. And they listed them right there. And so there you have the whole state of Ohio. And I, from what I understood, there was several other cities across the country that adopted that training manual. But right there, here's what you're expected to be as a firefighter. And I told people also, when I was filling out applications as a young kid, you know, wanting to take tests, they used to ask you, and this goes back to the type of person that you are and the type of person that we're looking for. They used to ask you things about your credit history.
Yeah.
Because you know why? One of those 13 traits in that fire service training manual from Ohio says you will be going into places of businesses. You will be going into banks. You'll be going into people's homes. Your integrity reflects on the fire service. It was something like that. I can't remember exactly. You know,
I got those questions. Those were included in my questions.
I'm glad you did. I don't see them anymore. I don't hear about them anymore because, you know, we're not supposed to offend anybody or hurt anybody's feelings, you know, or whatever the case may be. But those were the traits that we were looking for in the people coming into this job. And then, of course, I've always said probation was probation. Either you made the grade or you didn't. You know, it's just, you know, sorry, you know, you're just not cut out to be a fireman here, and that'll be it. So,
yeah,
that's what probation was for.
Yep.
So, Aaron, real quick, I want to start winding this down. Once again, I can't thank y'all enough. Justin Bemis is the if you ever listen to Sons of the Flag Radio, he's the incredible voice that you hear introducing. He doesn't sound anything like me. You know, I sound like this redneck from Texas. He's got this incredible radio voice. He wanted to ask you one question, and it's from a previous podcast you did. And on a past podcast, you talked about the stark difference between efficient and effective. How do you begin the process in the department who's been accepting a culture of efficiency and turn it into a mindset that we can become more effective? I know that's not off the mentorship topic, but I promised him since I had him, I'd give him one question.
Yeah, man. And you know what? I'll answer it in as succinctly as I can, but it's something that that's really getting deep into some of my principle-based approaches. So give him my phone number and let's he and I have an effective long-term conversation, but I will give him an efficient summary.
Okay. And Jeff, I'm sure he'll want your take too afterwards.
Efficiency is about pace. Effectiveness is about thoroughness. And in the fire service, we're trying to find the difference, the mean of the two. But the example that I can give that's super easy to understand is efficient in English has a secondary meaning. So there is a semantical meaning to everything we say, and the semantics are what we get caught up in because semantics change more rapidly than definitions. So if I say X is efficient, everybody has a mental image and a quality concept of what that means. But if I say Y is effective, there is a different gist, semantical difference. So effective means thorough, complete. Effectiveness in the long run not only leads to thorough and complete, but it also leads to more efficient. The catch is people get worried about efficiency, and efficient is quick, fast, immediate, but not as permanent and not as thorough and not as complete. And there's a secondary meaning in America, which is efficient means good, that comes from our time is money equation. Time is money, baby. People can make a lot of money really quickly and lose it really quickly. But if you make it effectively, slowly, methodically, ethically, the total sum product is better. You agree?
Absolutely.
So I use the example in the fire service of how our language, I mean, most of our training manuals, not all of them, but most of the modern training manuals say water is more efficient at absorbing heat in fine droplets. fog. But effectiveness, total control of the space for the objective that we're in there for, is done with a straight stream. And even the Europeans are starting to come around to that. Like, I mean, there is a time and place in ship holds and attics for steam. But in structural firefighting, it's really not our goal. Our goal is heat absorption without the increase in pressure that comes immediately from steam. We want to minimize that expansion time. So we don't look for efficient water use. We work for effective water use.
Yep.
Right? It's thorough, complete, and done once the right way. And does it use more water? It does. But efficient conversations come from thorough explanation, not Facebook and sound bites. That's efficient monologues, not effective conversations. So that's my difference. And we in the Western world are super, especially the first world, are super fucking hung up on efficiency. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in effectiveness. And it will be slower and more methodical. But because I approach it that way personally, I'm not worried about the 15-year project of implementing of this program in my own fire department. Because 15 years in an agency that old is nothing. It's a lot of my career, but in the grand scheme of things, it's effective. And we're starting to see the real benefits of effective transmission and where our engine company work is at right now. When I'm talking about this, I'm talking about not only do how we choose our words matter, but also how patient are you willing to be? Like, how bad do you want to win? Because I've launched technical explorations that took 10 years to manifest before it was ever successful for me in a match. And that's worth it. Because I'm not interested in the quick fix. I'm interested in the permanent long term. And that only comes with, that's how I differentiate the two. On a little side note, and then I'd really like to hear what Jeff has to say. I was in a conversation with a chief of mine who we get along, and he made a reference. We get along really well. I have a lot of respect for him. He's retired. And when he was retiring, we had a few nice things to say to each other, because that's what we do right before. We don't say nice things during the previous years, right when he's getting ready to go. And he says to me, he says, "Fields, I've really appreciated your informal leadership throughout the course of this." And I stopped moving and I looked down, and he's like, "What are you doing?" And I'm like, "Well, I'm making sure my pants are on." And he's like, "What?" And I'm like, "Well, you said informal. So I thought maybe I was informal." I'm like, "Chief, I understand what you're saying. And I really appreciate the compliment. But informal implies semantically that my demonstration of leadership, what you're defining as my leadership, is somehow less than any other leadership because of my rank." And he's like, "Yeah." And I said, and I gave the same thing I said to you guys earlier, leadership's a behavior pattern. Formal or there's no such thing as informal leadership. That's just leadership. And he looks at me and he goes, "Fields, that's a semantical argument." And I looked at him and I said, "Chief, I'm a linguist. That's what I went to college for, linguistics and history. Every argument is an argument of semantics. That's the definition of an argument." He's like, "God damn it, just take a compliment." we kind of walk away laughing and it's all good. But, you know, that's kind of the point, right? It's about effective and being thorough and taking the time, and there's no shortcut. We stay efficient. People are like, "How can I cut some time off my training?" I'm like, "I'm going to tell you that this series of skills, you can't. It takes this amount of time. And if you're either willing to pay it or you're not, that's the question. There's no way to shortcut it, you know?"
No.
So that's it.
Jeff, your turn.
God, how do I build on that one? Efficiency? Well, we have a saying, like, when we go out, simplicity equals efficiency. Keep things simple. Eliminate the steps from if you want to use an illustration, the engine arrives at the scene of a fire, whether it's a house or an apartment building or whatever the case may be. The engine arrives at the scene of a fire. There's a lot of things to look at from a resource standpoint. Your engine, its equipment, but the personnel, the most important thing you got. And whether you have three, four, I don't know, who sees five, maybe Chicago, maybe New York, and so forth. But nevertheless, you know, you've got your resource categories to work with, those three resources, personnel, apparatus, and equipment. So for efficiency's sake, you should be keeping your operations as simple as possible. And yet, we talked about it earlier with this thing, the computer. We have people putting stuff on the internet. My God, yeah, you know, you wonder, how can they ever get anything done? How can they ever get any water in a fire? Because they got collapse. Their hose is packed in such a way that, you know, it takes five guys to stretch it, and they've only got three guys on the engine, and there's the burning house or the building right there.
But Jeff, they're wearing their gear. They've got cool gear on.
That's true.
Yeah.
And don't forget, they got to go through two cars.
Yeah. We got to build this maze and that and everything else, you know, to make a point. Make a point about what? And if you had simplicity in mind, it's just like, you know, when I was a student, believe it or not, I was at one time, you know, University of Cincinnati. In there, you studied industrial applications, and that was, you know, like your timed experiments, you know, the old Hawthorne project there, and you might know about that. And, you know, what they were doing was looking at these steps that are taken and how they affect the overall end goal. Well, when the fire truck gets to the scene of a fire, we got three people on it. How do they get that line? And again, it's an obvious fire. It's not up for debate about what's happening there. How do those three guys get a line out quickly, which is your efficiency? What kind of line are they getting out? How is it equipped with the nozzle that they've got? Because we got some people out there who are now making the argument that we could take less water in, and how I just don't follow that. If we have people from the 60s and 70s saying the fires have become more intense, greater heat, greater smoke production, and all this other stuff, and we've increased the size of hose lines, and we wanted to increase the flow along with the 15, 16th nozzles and so forth. And now what we've seen in the last 15 or so years with hose manufacturing, the liner materials allows us to flow greater volumes of water with lesser friction loss per length of hose. So that helps us to keep the pressures down in the nozzles. So when we have that three-member company that stretches that line into that building, number one, your hose bed should be set up simple for that quick stretch, efficiency, the effectiveness of that hose line. Take as much water into battle with you as you can, and then blast away. Go ahead.
Sorry about that, Jeff. If I knock 5 seconds off my stretch, I think you and I have talked about this a lot.
Yeah.
The effectiveness comes in with, if I knock 5 seconds onto my stretch time, but because I do that, I more effectively lay my hose, and my total evolution time is 45 seconds, then I've made it more efficient by doing it more effective. And that was that point I was trying to make about, it's this balance point. Sometimes you sacrifice speed of the moment for speed of the total. And like you're saying, super, you and I have talked about this a lot, yes. So I know. Yes. And it's about simple, keep it simple.
Right, exactly, keep it simple. You know, and that other thing about, you know, what you find out, you know, again, you get older guys in the job. And again, I was very lucky to work with a lot of guys who had a ton of fires under their belt. You know, they went through the riots and all that stuff. And, you know, as a young kid, you're full of piss and vinegar, or oil and vinegar, as some people say, you know, and you want to get off that apparatus and run. And they'll hold on, kid, get back here. Okay. Walk, because that's all you got to do is run, trip, break your nose. Now we lose you. Okay. Besides that, your job is here on this apparatus or this company and so forth. And that's what we, you know, have to do. Yeah. Again, harnessing that energy. And again, you know, what we see today is so many things that, you know, again, the, you know, the train's off the tracks in some areas, you know, because as you pointed out, running, well, what does that do? I was that kid, by the way, you know, when I made reference to that fire I was going to as a youngster, you know, when the senior man across the engine from me says, follow the senior man, what good would I have been and what effectiveness would I have been to get off my engine and run towards the fire without the rest of the crew? What effectiveness do I have? None. And that's what the engine crew is all about. And yep. I think a lot of people, a lot of younger officers, a lot of older officers too, in fact, you know, don't get that mentality and so forth.
Well, yeah. This just bit me. I mean, you know, I think one of the things that the fire service does is they assume that after a certain point, you don't make mistakes. So we just had a fire a couple shifts ago where we're pulling in. I heard part of the radio traffic. I thought I heard the whole thing. And we're pulling up. The first crew pulled a 2.5. We're going to pull a 2.5. And I thought I heard my boss say, we're on the plug. He didn't. He said, engine 6 is on the plug. 2.5. I'm looking at it. I'm like, yeah, we're going with our 200-foot 2.5. We're going to stay away from the bulk of it. I jump off the rig, and I come around to the back, and I'm sitting there kind of like waiting for my nozzle guy, and he's not there. And I'm like, maybe he fell down. I'll pull this 2.5. So I grab the 2.5 and start taking off. And then I hear him say, it feels. And I turn around, and here he comes up with the line from the right engine. We weren't on the hydrant. I missed the, you know, and I'm looking at him. I'm like, oh, shit. He's like, we're not on a hydrant. I thought we're on a hydrant. He's like, no. So I'd go and effectively put the line back, and then we get the line in place and go about it. But, you know, the other thing is that, like, I just the other day, one of the newer folks was asking me about the fire. And the first thing I talked about was that mistake. This is why we're sure. And this is why I should have taken 5 seconds and looked around the other side of the rig. But I was so sure that I'd heard everything right that I just started to do. And it wasn't catastrophic, but it illustrates that point of, you know, 5 seconds would have saved 15. You know? And so, you know, so I apologize to my captain, and he's like, oh, I didn't even notice. And apologize to my nozzle guy, and he's like, I thought you fell down. That's funny because I thought you fell down.
But the important thing there, Aaron, is you owned it.
Oh, hell yeah. I make all mistakes all the time.
Oh, God, yeah.
That's why I practice.
You know, nobody's going to get in trouble.
That thing you just said about, you know, if we said it one time and we performed just to that level of what we think we're performing at, all the time, well, then there'd be no need for training.
Right.
That ain't the way it is, okay? Nope. Everything's circumstantial at our job. So.
Yep.
Well, guys, Aaron, I know you're tired, and Shoop, you may have to run somewhere here pretty soon. I want to give y'all
– Still sunlight here.
Still sunlight.
What is it?
It's setting. Whatever it is, it's – way past you.
Yeah. So I can't thank y'all enough. You know, it's been a dream of mine to get y'all two together. And Aaron, thank you for actually making it happen. I know you're busy. Shoot. Oh. Let me put that
up there. It's great. Thanks for inviting us.
Oh, no. And thank you to Fire Engineering Blog Talk Radio. Anything y'all want to say before we go?
Well, no, we'll have to do it again sometime. Aaron, you up for it?
Yeah, anytime, of course. I'm going to be a little wrapped up for the rest of this week, but I'll give you a call next week and we can just generally catch up. I'm really glad you're healthy.
Yeah, well, thank you. I'm glad to be too.
Yeah.
It's the general, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. for sure. Boy, she's making a recovery, so.
Yeah, that's great.
Aaron, real quick, let people know where you're going to be, if you're going to be anywhere. I know we talked about it briefly the other day.
No, yeah, we're picking back up. It's, you know, we've got plenty of people that want the program. There's a lot of people in a holding pattern, but our next program will be in San Diego and in mid-January. And then we'll be in right north of Seattle in late January. And then we've almost got the whole year charted out. We're waiting to hear back from a few people before we update the website. The website's a little, you know, clearly because of this year, but we started back up in October. So it's a little lower key, but that's okay. I mean, it's the long run. It's the marathon, not the sprint.
Yeah.
Yep. Shoop, you got anything in the works?
Who knows? Sure, we got a lot of things in the works. It's just that everything's up in the air, you know?
Yeah.
Once again, guys, thank you all for being here. Right. Thank you to Fire Engineering Blog Talk Radio. Everybody have a Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. Be safe.
Thanks. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Sons of the Flag Radio. We truly hope that you enjoyed tonight's episode. If you would like to listen to other episodes, then log on to Fire Engineering Blog Talk Radio and type in Sons of the Flag, or log on to YouTube and type in Sons of the Flag. If you'd like to support Sons of the Flag or join the team at Sons of the Flag, or just like to see a list of any of our upcoming events, then again, log on to our website at www.sonsoftheflag.org, and be sure to look us up on all social media by typing in @sonsoftheflag. As always, we thank you for listening. We ask that you stay safe, stay passionate, keep the mission first, and all of us at Sons of the Flag wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, and we look forward to the next year of 2021. Stay safe.